Up next, we go back to New York for an address by Cuba's President Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez, speaking at the 73rd session of the UN General Assembly's General Debate.
Mr. President, it is impossible to be here and speak from this rostrum on behalf of Cuba and not to recall historical moments of the General Assembly, which are also part of our dearest memories. Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Raúl Castro.
Y el canciller de la dignidad, por solo citar los más trascendentes, trajeron hasta aquí no solo la voz de nuestro pueblo, sino la de otros pueblos latinoamericanos y asiáticos no alineados con los que hemos
with whom we have shared over half a century of battles for a just international order that is still far from being reached. It is absurd but consistent with the rationality of a world in which the richest 0.7% of the population owns 46% of all the wealth, while the poorest 70% of the population can access only 2.7% of it. 3.4 billion people survive in poverty. 815 million are going hungry, 758 million are illiterate, and 844 million lack basic services of drinking water. All these figures, by the way, are prepared and regularly used by global organizations, but it seems that they have failed yet still to raise sufficient awareness of the international community. Mr. President, these realities are not the result of socialism, like the President of the United States said yesterday here. They are the consequence of capitalism, especially imperialism and neoliberalism, of selfishness and exclusion that is inherent to that system, and of economic, political, social, and cultural paradigm that privileges wealth accumulation in the hands of a few at the cost of the exploitation and the poverty of the large majorities. Capitalism consolidated colonialism. It gave birth to fascism, terrorism, and apartheid, and spread wars and conflicts, the breaches of sovereignty and self-determination of the peoples, repression on workers, minorities, refugees, and migrants. Capitalism is opposed to solidarity and democratic participation. The production and consumption patterns that characterize it promote plunder, militarism, threats to peace. They generate violations of human rights and are the greatest danger to the ecological balance of the planet and the survival of human beings. No one should be deceived by anybody claiming that humanity lacks enough material, financial, and technological resources to eradicate poverty, hunger, preventable diseases, and all the scourges. What is lacking is the political will of the industrial countries, who have the moral duty, the historical responsibility, and the abundant resources to solve the most pressing global problems. The truth is that while it is claimed that there is a shortfall in funding to attain the goals and targets of the 2030 Agenda or address the increasing impact of climate change, in 2017, the military expenditure amounted to $1.74 trillion. The highest figure since the end of the Cold War. Climate change is another unavoidable reality and a matter of survival for the human species, particularly for small island developing states. Some of its effects are already irreversible. Scientific evidence indicates there is an increase of 1.1 centigrade degrees relative to the industrial period, and 9 out of 10 persons are living polluted air. Breathing polluted air. However, the U.S., one of the most important polluters yesterday and today, refuses to accompany the international community in the implementation of the Paris Agreement on climate change. It thus endangers the lives of future generations and the survival of all species, including humans. In addition, and as if there were not enough threats on humanity and its dazzling creations, it is a fact that the military and nuclear hegemonism of imperialism is perpetuating itself and expanding to the detriment of the hopes of the majority of the peoples for a general and complete disarmament. It is an idea Cuba shares, and as proof of its commitment on joining the 31st last, Cuba became the fifth state to ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. In this organization that was born out of the human desire to overcome the destruction left by a terrible war with the dialogue between nations, it is not possible not to ignore these dangers that include the aggression war disguised as humanitarian interventions, the forceful overthrow of sovereign governments, the so-called soft coups, and interference in other states' internal affairs. These are recurrent forms of actions by some powers using the most diverse excuses. International cooperation for the promotion and protection of all human rights for all is a must. However, its discriminatory and selective manipulation with claims of domination violates the rights to peace, self-determination, and development of peoples. Cuba rejects the militarization of outer space and cyberspace, as well as the covert and illegal use of information and communication technologies to attack other states. The exercise of multilateralism and the full respect for the principles and rules of international law to advance towards a multipolar, democratic, and equitable world are requirements to guarantee peaceful coexistence, preserve international peace and security, and find lasting solutions to systemic problems. Against that logic, the threat of the use of force, unilateralism, pressures, retaliations, and sanctions, which increasingly characterize the behavior and rhetoric of the U.S. government, and its abusive use of the veto power in the Security Council in order to impose their political agenda, pose huge challenges and threats within the United Nations itself. Why don't we just implement the promised strengthening of the General Assembly as the main organ of deliberation, decision, and representation? The reform of the Security Council must be delayed or prevented, as this organ is in need of adjusting its style to the times in its work and membership. Today, we have come to reiterate what Commander-in-Chief Fidel Castro Ruz said on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the UN, which summarizes the most noble aspiration of the majority of humanity, and I quote, "We want a world without hegemonistic practices, without nuclear weapons, without interventionism, without racism, without national or religious hatred, without violations of the sovereignty of any country, respect for independence and the free determination of peoples, without universal models that do not take into account the traditions and cultures of all components of humanity at all, without cruel blockades that kill men, women, children, young and elderly persons like silent atomic bombs." Over 20 years have passed since that demand, and none of those ills have been cured. In fact, they have worsened. We have every right to ask why, and we have the duty to insist on effective and equitable solutions. Mr. President, our America is today experiencing persistent threats inconsistent with the proclamation of Latin America and the Caribbean as a zone of peace, signed in Havana by the heads of state and government on the occasion of the second summit of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States in 2014. The current U.S. administration has proclaimed the relevance of the Monroe Doctrine, and in a new deployment of its imperial policy in the region, is attacking Venezuela with a special cruelty. In that threatening context, we wish to reiterate our absolute support to the Bolivarian and Chavista Revolution, the civic military union of the Venezuelan people, and the legitimate and democratic government led by constitutional President Nicolás Maduro Moros. We reject the intervention attempts and sanctions against Venezuela aimed at suffocating it economically and hurting Venezuelan families. We likewise reject the attempts at destabilizing the Nicaraguan government, a country of peace that has made a remarkable social, economic, and public safety progress in favor of its people. We denounce the politically motivated imprisonment of former President Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva and the decision to prevent the people from voting and electing Brazil's most popular leader to the presidency. We stand in solidarity with the Caribbean nations who demand legitimate reparations for the horrible effects of slavery, as well as the just, special, and differential treatment that they deserve. We reaffirm our historical commitment with the self-determination independence of the brotherly people of Puerto Rico. We support Argentina's legitimate sovereignty claim over the Malvinas Islands, South Sandwich, and South Georgia Islands. We reiterate our unrestricted support to the comprehensive, just, and lasting solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the basis of the creation of two states, allowing the Palestinian people to exercise their right to self-determination and to have an independent and sovereign state based upon the pre-1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital. We reject the unilateral action of the United States to establish its diplomatic representation in the city of Jerusalem, which heightens even more tensions in the region. We condemn the barbarities of the Israeli forces against the civilian population in Gaza. We reaffirm our steadfast solidarity with the Sahrawi people and support the search for the final solution to the question of Western Sahara, which will allow them to exercise self-determination and to live in peace in their territory. We support the search for a peaceful and negotiated solution to the situation imposed in Syria, without foreign interference and with full respect to its sovereignty and territorial integrity. We reject any direct or indirect intervention carried out without the legitimate authorities of that country.
The continued expansion of NATO towards the Russian borders is causing serious threats, worsened by the imposition of arbitrary sanctions, which we reject. We demand compliance with the Islamic Republic of Iran's nuclear deal. We welcome the process of rapprochement and dialogue between the two Koreas, which is the way for achieving a lasting peace, reconciliation, and stability in the Korean Peninsula. At the same time, we strongly condemn the imposition of unilateral and unfair sanctions against the Democratic Republic, People's Republic of Korea, and foreign interference in Korean internal affairs, the violation of the rules of international trade, and the sanctions against China, the European Union, and other countries will bring about harmful effects, particularly for developing states. We advocate for dialogue and cooperation, thanks to which we can report today that the Cuba-EU Agreement on Political Dialogue and Cooperation has provisionally entered into force and is a good foundation to develop beneficial ties between both parties. Mr. President, the government of the U.S. keeps an aggressive rhetoric towards Cuba and maintains a policy aimed at subverting the political, economic, social, economic, and cultural system in my country. Contrary to the interests of both peoples and giving in to the pressures of a minority of sectors, the new U.S. government has devoted itself to artificially fabricate under false pretenses scenarios of tension and hostility that serve nobody's interests. This is in contrast with the fact that we have formal diplomatic relations and mutually beneficial cooperation programs in a limited number of areas. Our peoples share increasingly closer historic and cultural bonds, which are expressed in the arts, sports, sciences, in the environment, among others. The potential for a smooth, fluent business relationship is well known, and a genuine and respectful understanding would be in the best interest of the entire region. However, the essential and defining element of the bilateral relationship continues to be the blockade, which seeks to suffocate the Cuban economy in order to bring about hardships and disrupt our constitutional order. It is a cruel policy, punishing Cuban families and the entire nation. It is the most comprehensive and long-standing system of economic nations or sanctions ever implemented. It has been and continues to be a major obstacle to the country's development and to the realization of the aspirations to progress and well-being of several generations of Cubans. as it has been said for so many years in this same forum, due to its aggressive extraterritorial implementation, the blockade seriously damages the sovereignty and interests of all countries. On behalf of the Cuban people, I would like to thank this General Assembly for the virtually unanimous rejection of the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the United States against my country. Nevertheless, the actions of the U.S. government against my country go further. They include public and covert programs of gross interference in Cuba's internal affairs. To this end, tens of millions of dollars are officially allocated in its budget in violation of the standards and principles upon which this organization lies, and in particular on Cuba's sovereignty as an independent nation. Cuba stands ready to develop respectful and civilized relations with the U.S. government on the basis of sovereign equality and mutual respect. This is the will of the Cuban people, and we know this is a shared aspiration by most U.S. citizens, and particularly by Cubans living here. We shall continue to tirelessly demand the end of the cruel economic, commercial, and financial blockade, the return of the illegally occupied territory of the Guantanamo Naval Base, and adequate reparations for our people, for the thousands of the dead and disabled, and for the economic and property damages caused to Cuba over so many years of aggression. Cuba will always be willing to engage in dialogue and cooperate on the basis of respect and on an equal footing. We shall never make concessions affecting the sovereignty and national independence. We shall not negotiate our principles, nor shall we accept conditionalities. In spite of the blockade, the hostility, and the actions carried out by the United States to impose a regime change in Cuba, the Cuban Revolution is right here, alive and kicking, true to its principle. Mr. President, the generational change in our government should not raise the hopes of the enemies of the revolution. We are the continuity, not a rupture. Cuba has continued taking steps to improve its model of economic and social development in order to build a sovereign, independent, socialist, democratic, prosperous, and sustainable nation. That is the path we have chosen freely. The Cuban people will never go back to the opprobrious past that it shook off with the greatest sacrifices during 150 years of struggle for independence and full dignity. By the decision of the overwhelming majority of Cubans, we shall continue the process that started almost 60 years ago. In this conviction, we began a constitutional reform process, a truly participatory and democratic exercise. Through popular discussion of the draft, which will eventually be approved in a referendum, I am certain that there will be no changes in our strategic objectives and that the irrevocable nature of socialism will be ratified. The principles of foreign policy will remain unchanged. As the first secretary of our party, Raul Castro, said on his statement on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of the United Nations, and I quote, "The international community will always be able to count on Cuba's sincere voice against injustice, inequality, underdevelopment, discrimination, and manipulation, and for the establishment of a fairer and more equitable international order whose center is placed on the human being, its dignity and well-being. The Cuban behalf of which I speak today is the proud successor of that independent, sovereign, fraternal, and solidarity policy with the poorest of this world, producers of all the wealth in the planet, although the unequal global order has sentenced them to dire poverty. On behalf of words like democracy, freedom, and human rights, words which the rich have actually emptied of meaning. It has been exciting to take the floor at the same rostrum from which Fidel expressed powerful truths 58 years ago that still continue to shake us in front of representatives of more than 119 nations who, rejecting extortion and pressures, every year fill the voting screen of worthy green lights of approval to our demand for the end of the blockade. I conclude by expressing my hope that the noble aspirations of most of the humanity will be achieved before younger generations take again this rostrum to demand the same things we demand today and our historic predecessors did before us. Thank you very much.
Up next, Bolivia's President Evo Morales, also addressing the 73rd session of the UN General Assembly's General Debate earlier this week.
Hermana Presidenta, la Asamblea.
Madam President of the United Nations General Assembly, may I take this opportunity of congratulating you on your election to this very important post. Secretary General of the United Nations, brothers and sisters, heads of state and government, brothers and sisters of delegations, the men, women, and children throughout the world, everywhere in the world, in planet Earth, expect our discussions here to have some actual output, a result, improving their lives. The world can see that the leaders meet once a year, and they hope that we will faithfully discharge our mandate to build a society that is fairer for everyone. When the United Nations was established after the Second World War, we set forth clear purposes which we can now use to measure our triumphs and our failures, the threats and the opportunities. Our purposes at that time were to preserve peace and international security and justice so as to prevent and put an end to threats and in order to put an end to aggression. We also resolved to resolve our disputes by peaceful means. We undertook to encourage relations of friendship among all nations based on respect for the principle of equal rights and self-determination of the peoples. Brothers and sisters, the theme for this session of the General Assembly is making the United Nations relevant to all people. Global leadership and shared responsibility for peaceful, equitable, and sustainable societies. And I would like to take a practical look at the principles enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations. Member states have an obligation to settle their international disputes by peaceful means so as not to jeopardize international peace or security and not to undermine justice. I would like to take this opportunity of referring to the case submitted by Bolivia to the International Court of Justice, which will be settled next week. This case relates to the obligation for Chile to negotiate with Bolivia in an effective and timely manner to ensure sovereign access for us to the Pacific Ocean. This involves the responsibility of both of our states. We have to find just solutions in the framework of international law. In 2015, the International Court agreed to consider this international dispute, whose hemispheric interest was acknowledged by the Organization of American States also. It involves two neighbors and regional integration. We really wish to find a good faith solution with Chile and a lasting solution which will be sustainable and which will be mutually satisfactory so that we can put an end to this 100-year-old dispute between these two neighbors. Our country was deprived of access to the Pacific Ocean. And this has had a real negative impact on our human and economic development. Bolivia's call to have access to the sea is involved with our right to enjoy the huge resources of the sea and to take a broader view of the entire planet, to enjoy the common heritage of mankind. A human being needs the sea. You cannot have life on land without water, and you cannot think of people living without any access to the sea. The sea is not just an outlet for trade or for the market or modern trading. Rather, the sea is a window to other peoples. It is a window to life itself. We hope that the decision that will be taken into the International Court of Justice will be recognized and will help to bring the parties together so that fruitful negotiations can be undertaken. We also hope that we will also enjoy support from the international community, because it is very important to have a genuine agreement that looks at the causes and the effects of this dispute, which for over 100 years, one whole century, has kept us apart one from the other. One has to take a critical look at inadequate agreements in the past. We want to ensure mutual advantages within the framework of regional and global integration. We want to have these two peoples reconciled. It is quite ridiculous that they have been distanced one from the other for reasons that do not relate to their fraternal desire to coexist. The dispute between Bolivia and Chile over access to the Pacific Ocean is not just a recent political or electoral issue. This dispute goes back to the very beginning of our territorial dispute in the late 19th century, when foreign corporate interests that wanted to exploit the natural resources in Atacama were involved. They wanted to exploit guano, saltpeter, silver, copper, and they encouraged an asymmetrical, warlike and expansionist approach in the region. So now Bolivia is landlocked, and one cannot resolve this matter by invoking inadequate agreements from the past or compromises that did not work. The people of Bolivia have been calling for a solution for over 100 years, regionally and multilaterally. Bolivia is sure that the decision to be taken by the International Court of Justice, regardless of the scope of that decision, will introduce a new atmosphere in the relationship between Bolivia and Chile, so that we can find mutually acceptable and lasting solutions. Our peoples want peace, and we have political will, and this must be used in order to find possible solutions that will work, where both sides will feel they have won rather than having been defeated. Older and more difficult disputes in the world have, in fact, been resolved through creative and effective diplomacy. Bolivia and Chile and their peoples and their governments must await tranquilly a judicial decision, a judgment, which, regardless of the formal aspect of it, will open up a new era of peace, justice, and fraternity. The member states of the United Nations should also pay attention to this matter, for this will be a decision by the principal judiciary body, which has agreed to consider this dispute and take a decision on it and offer guidelines on a solution. And this would then establish a precedent for fairer societies with shared responsibilities to find solutions to disputes. This is unlike what has happened in the past, when warlike approaches and desires to achieve domination prevailed. However, our case is very relevant to the theme of this 73rd session of the General Assembly. Brothers and sisters, we have often drawn this Assembly's attention to the many crises facing mankind and life on Earth. Unfortunately, every year we come to the Assembly to say that despite many commendable efforts, so many of these crises have gotten even worse and more serious. I would like to talk about the three major threats we face. The first is climate change. Every year it's hotter than it was the year before. Every year there are more harsher phenomena that occur. Every year more human beings are affected irreversibly by hurricanes, by flooding, by droughts, by pollution. Global efforts such as the Paris Agreement are important, but until we tackle the structural causes of this crisis, we will not be able to put a stop to it. Particularly when the main polluter in the history of the human race, the United States, simply turns its back on science and on multilateralism, and thus on the human race. Climate change is an inevitable consequence of capitalism. Overproduction, unsustainable consumption patterns. The planet is being exhausted, and life too. The second major threat is the arms race. The culture of war, the possibility of a nuclear disaster, is something we all fear. Many leaders, particularly those that have the most weapons, come here to this forum and talk about peace. But at the same time, military expenditures are growing. In 2017, it was 1.1% more than it had been in 2016. 1,739 trillion dollars. This is 2.2% of the global GDP. The world cannot live like this. Those that feel they have the right to produce and use weapons that can completely eliminate life on Earth are imposing these expenditures. And the arms industry feeds off war. Weapons are being tested and they prove to be rather effective in killing children. And then the corporations' shares go up on the stock market. This is a criminal logic and it must be ended. The threat comes from those that are willing to invade countries to indulge in regime change in order to seize the natural resources of other peoples. Military bases are established. Brothers and sisters, the third major threat is inequality. Every year, wealth is being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. In 2017, 82% of the increase in world wealth went to the 1% richest people. Half of the human race saw no increase whatsoever in their income. According to Credit Suisse, 42 individuals hold today the same amount of wealth as 3,700 million people. These figures are simply shameful, and we should all be ashamed. This is not a model for distributing wealth. Rather, it is a model for accumulating wealth and distributing poverty. Brothers and sisters, Bolivia strongly rejects the illegal, inhuman, and criminal economic and financial blockade imposed against Cuba by the United States. The United States has an obligation to provide economic reparations for the damage done to the Cuban people, who are heroes. The resolutions of the General Assembly must be implemented, the blockade lifted immediately. Moreover, Guantanamo should be returned to Cuban sovereignty, and there should be no interference in the internal affairs. We have followed closely the progress and difficulties incurred in implementing the peace agreement signed between the government of Colombia and FARC, as we have been members of the Security Council. We hope that the new government of Colombia will continue with social and economic reintegration of ex-combatants and will protect the lives of those who have defended human rights and leaders of the peoples. The efforts being made show once again that Latin America and the Caribbean are a peace-loving area, brothers and sisters. The sister Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela is suffering from outright aggression by the United States and its allies. Latin America strongly rejects attempts to intervene militarily in Venezuela. Venezuelan problems have to be resolved by the Venezuelan people themselves. The United States must immediately withdraw illegal and unilateral steps it has taken, which have been, in fact, one of the causes of the economic situation in that country. We take the opportunity to condemn also the criminal Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. We also condemn the unilateral and illegal decision by the government of the United States declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel. That decision, in fact, jeopardizes any possibility of achieving a just or lasting peace. We reiterate our support for a two-state solution, with a Palestinian state that is free, independent, and sovereign, with borders prior to 1967, and with Eastern Jerusalem as its capital. We deeply regret that the war in Syria has led to over 500,000 deaths in the 8 years of that war. That is the result of policies seeking to regime change. It's the result of a policy of intervening in internal affairs and seizing natural resources. Bolivia rejects violations of sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, which directly or even indirectly are perpetrated by various states, including the United States. It is our hope that the United Nations will do its utmost to achieve a political agreement which will benefit the Syrian people very soon. We appreciate and welcome the efforts being made by Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Kazakhstan to put an end to further suffering of the Syrian people. Brothers and sisters, in concluding, I have to report to you on the situation in Bolivia. As you know, we have gotten rid of United States military bases and of U.S. aid and IDE, and we have gotten rid of impositions from the International Monetary Fund. And now Bolivia is an example to the region and to the world. We have one of the fastest growing economies in the region. We have reduced extreme poverty from 37% to 17% in the last 10 years. We've increased life expectancy by 8 years. We've reduced infant mortality by 56%. We reduced chronic infant malnutrition by 50%. We have invested more money in renewable energies compared to the GDP than any other country. And we are building a society that is fairer, more just. We also have an initiative to combat corruption, and the president and vice president have abandoned any and put an end to any kind of banking secrecy. And we call on all heads of state to support this kind of measure so as to ensure the greatest possible transparency in governance. And this has been achieved thanks to the unity of the Bolivian people and our defense of our sovereignty and our recuperation of our natural resources and strategic enterprises, a pluralistic economic model, and redistribution of wealth. Brothers and sisters, we confirm our commitment to multilateralism. Together we must build a society with equal opportunity for one and all. We must have a planet that is cared for because it is our only home. We must build a world where justice is possible and peace is with us. Thank you.
Up next, the President of the Republic of Korea, or South Korea, President Moon Jae-in.
Madam President, Mr. Secretary General, and distinguished delegates, I'd like to express my deepest condolences on the passing of Kofi Annan, the 7th Secretary General of the United Nations. The world will forever remember his name that has been etched in the road to peace. I'd like to congratulate Ms. Maria Espinosa on assuming the presidency of the General Assembly. I hope the United Nations will be able to reach out to every corner of the globe through the 73rd session of the General Assembly. I also hope that the United Nations will make further progress in contributing to the international community under Secretary General Antonio Guterres' excellent leadership. As I had done last year, I stand here once again with a sense of urgency and excitement. Over the past year, something miraculous has taken place on the Korean Peninsula. For the first time in history, the leader of North Korea crossed the military demarcation line to visit Panmunjom. A historic summit between the United States and North Korea was held on the Sentosa Island in Singapore. Chairman Kim Jong-un and I removed the shadow of war and resolved to usher in an era of peace and prosperity. At the U.S.-North Korea summit, the two sides agreed to work towards achieving complete denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula and ending hostile relations and establishing a permanent peace regime. President Trump and Chairman Kim moved and gave hope to those who desire peace all around the world. North Korea dismantled its nuclear test site in Punggye-ri under the observation of the international community. The United States and the Republic of Korea suspended large-scale joint military exercises and built trust. I'd like to thank and salute President Trump and Chairman Kim's courage and resolve as they usher in a new era on the Korean Peninsula as well as in U.S.-North Korea relations. Last week in Pyongyang, I met Chairman Kim for the third time and reached an agreement once again to turn the Korean Peninsula into a land of peace, free from nuclear weapons and threats. Chairman Kim expressed his hope of completing denuclearization as soon as possible to focus on economic development. Moreover, Chairman Kim expressed his commitment to permanently dismantle the missile engine test site and launch platform in Dongchang-ri under observation of the international community as a first step in order to expedite progress in denuclearization. Furthermore, he expressed his firm willingness to continue to take additional denuclearization measures, including the permanent dismantlement of nuclear facilities in Yongbyon, as the United States takes corresponding measures in the spirit of the Sentosa Agreement. The Korean Peninsula has remained under the armistice over the past 65 years. Ending the Korean War is an urgent task. It's a process that we must go through in order to move towards a peace regime. I look forward to seeing bold measures for denuclearization implemented among the related countries, leading to the declaration to end the war. Regardless of the challenges that lie ahead, the leaders of the South, North, and the United States will move step by step towards peace based on mutual trust. Such a dramatic change has been possible thanks to the support and encouragement of the people around the world who desire peace. In particular, the United Nations gave North Korea the courage to embark on the road to peace. I'd like to express my gratitude to the United Nations for its role. However, this is just the beginning. I'd like to ask for continued support and cooperation from the member states on our journey towards a complete denuclearization and permanent peace. The Republic of Korea will spare no effort to encourage North Korea's participation in the international community while adhering to the resolutions adopted by the United Nations. Madam President, last winter, a prelude to peace on the Korean Peninsula unfolded in Pyeongtaek in Gangwon Province. It was a moment when the Olympic Truce Resolution adopted at the UN General Assembly in November 2017 came to precious fruition. Secretary-General Guterres and many heads of state extended their congratulations on the participation of North Korean athletes and officials in the Pyeongchang Olympic Winter Games. They expressed their wishes for unity and peace on the Korean Peninsula. The world was awakened to the sense of new history of peace being written. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the IOC President Thomas Bach for his leadership and contribution in opening the way for North Korea to participate in the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. Just over a month after the close of the Pyeongchang Paralympic Winter Games, Chairman Kim and I met for the first time in Panmunjom. The United Nations welcomed and actively supported the adoption of the Panmunjom Declaration. By doing so, it provided tremendous strength and force to the meetings that followed, including the Second Korea Summit, the U.S.-North Korea Summit, and the recent Inter-Korean Summit in Pyongyang. At the 72nd session of the U.N. General Assembly, I expressed the hope that North Korea will choose peace on its own accord and in order to establish a sound and sustainable peace. This hope was shared by the United Nations and all of the international community. North Korea responded positively to our hopes and calls. Chairman Kim changed the direction of the political situation on the Korean Peninsula through his New Year's address on the first day of this year. The participation of North Korea's athletes and the delegation in the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics provided a decisive momentum to break the impasse in building peace. On April 20th, North Korea officially ended its policy of nuclear development and has since devoted all of its efforts towards economic development. On September 9th, in the ceremony marking the 70th anniversary of its foundation, North Korea expressed its commitment to peace and prosperity instead of boasting its nuclear capabilities. North Korea moved out of long-standing isolation on its own initiative and stands before the international community once again. Now it is the international community's turn to respond positively to North Korea's new choices and efforts. We must assure Chairman Kim that he has made the right decision in committing to denuclearization. We must encourage North Korea to stay on the path that leads to permanent and solid peace.
The role of the United Nations is crucial. The United Nations Secretariat has continued its efforts for dialogue and engagement, including the invitation of North Korean officials to international conferences. The United Nations has stated its commitment to leave no one behind. My sincere hope is that the UN's vision of sustainable development will be realized on the Korean Peninsula. I have no doubt that if the international community paves the way, North Korea will not stall on making strides toward peace and prosperity. The Republic of Korea will spare no efforts to guide North Korea towards that path. I would like to call on the UN to share its experience and wisdom. Madam President, The process of working towards denuclearization and establishing peace on the Korean Peninsula is a process that also leads to building peace and cooperation in Northeast Asia. Northeast Asia is home to one-fifth of the world's population, and it accounts for a quarter of the global economy. However, regional conflicts stand in the way of pursuing broader cooperation. We'll begin the work of resolving conflicts in Northeast Asia, starting from the Korean Peninsula. On August 15th, I proposed the creation of an East Asian Railroad Community, which would involve six Northeast Asian countries and the United States. The European Coal and Steel Community, which gave birth to the creation of the European Union, is a living example of what this kind of initiative could achieve. I believe that the East Asian Railroad Community will be able to serve as a starting point for the creation of an energy and economic community in East Asia, and going a step further, lead to multilateral peace and security architecture in Northeast Asia. The two Koreas are working to reconnect railroads and roads that has been disconnected. Going forward, the Republic of Korea will be engaging in close consultation with countries in the regions on concrete steps toward the East Asian Railroad Community as we work to realize the UN spirit of multilateralism and pave the way for a future of shared prosperity. I'd like to ask for support and cooperation of the international community. Madam President, the Republic of Korea, together with the UN, has weathered the storms of the modern history. The UN and Republic of Korea share common values and philosophies. This month, the government of Republic of Korea announced its visions of an inclusive nation based on a people-centered governing philosophy. We are moving towards a fair and just nation, as well as a society in which no one is discriminated against and everyone lives in harmony. Inclusiveness is also a philosophy embedded in international development cooperation. The government of Republic of Korea will steadily expand its contribution to development cooperation to create a global community that leaves no one behind. The Republic of Korea is also increasing its assistance to people who are suffering from human rights violation and discrimination, particularly the most vulnerable groups, including children, youth, women, and those with disabilities. We increase our financial aid for refugees 5 times in the past 5 years. Starting from this year, Korea is providing 50,000 tons of rice every year to developing countries that are suffering from a severe food crisis. I believe that there needs to be a holistic approach encompassing peace, development, and human rights to fundamentally resolve humanitarian crisis. The government of Republic of Korea will engage in discussions and provide support to make the UN relevant to all people. This year marks the 70th anniversary of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Anyone who has confronted the abuse of power to advance human rights carries in his or her heart the first clause of the Declaration: all human beings are born free and equal. In particular, I am working to realize gender equality in tangible ways as an important part of our administrative agendas. All forms of discrimination and violence against women are being dealt with even more sternly. Korea has a direct experience of suffering from the Japanese military's mobilizations of comfort women. We will actively participate in discussions among the international community over women, peace and security. We'll also work together with the international community on the efforts to eradicate sexual violence in conflict. Responding to climate change and transitioning to a low-carbon economy are challenges and tasks facing our generation. The government of Republic of Korea will raise its share of renewable energy in the nation's total power generation to 20% by 2030. We'll faithfully implement the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emission by 2030 in compliance with Paris Agreement and assist developing countries' pursue of sustainable development by supporting them with climate change response. Madam President, Secretary General, and distinguished delegates, for two Koreas, the significance of UN goes beyond any international organizations. At the 46th UN General Assembly on September 17, 1991, all of its 159 member states unanimously adopted the resolutions for joint accessions by South and North Korea to the UN. That day was coincidentally World Peace Day. The representative of South and North Korea pledged in their respective speeches that although South and North Korea studied a separate member, they would eventually become one someday through reconciliation, cooperation, and peace. Now, after 27 years have passed, South and North Korea are realizing the pledge made on that day. We have crossed the barriers of divisions and are tearing down the walls in our heart. We are proving to the international community that when we come together, we have sufficient means to establish peace. Ladies and gentlemen, we all desire peace. Peace represents the relatives and neighbors we love and the hometown that we long for. Peace means sharing what we have together. A peace we have all achieved together is a peace for all. I am confident that all of you will always be with us on the path to permanent peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, as well as on the journey to the peaceful world. Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.